Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to Policy Forum Pod, the podcast for those who want to dig a little deeper into the policy challenges facing Australia and the Asia-Pacific region. I'm Martin Pierce. Policy Forum Pod is a production of policyforum.net, which is based at Crawford School of Public Policy, the Asia-Pacific's leading graduate policy school. Has your work been affected by COVID-19? If so, have you thought of upskilling or changing your career? As part of the Australian government's relief package, ANU is now offering a range of new short courses, and Crawford is accepting applications for our new Graduate Certificate of Environmental Management online. This degree will provide you with an understanding of current issues and approaches to environmental management, of current regulatory and policy frameworks, and the ability to contribute to the governance of environmental sustainability and disasters. It's a really exciting thing to do. So find out more and get all the details on how to apply at crawford.anu.edu.au/study. Now, we're just about to get started with this week's episode, but before we do, I'd like to ask, have you heard of our Ask Policy Forum podcast series? If not, that might be because you're not yet a member of our pod squad. So now is the time to change that. Join us on Facebook, where we are Policy Forum Pod, and you can get access to this special pod series. It's the podcast where you take the reins, and you can ask us absolutely anything, and we'll get the experts together to answer your questions. So hit pause here just for a second. Join us on Facebook and send us your questions for the upcoming installment of Ask Policy Forum. We're looking forward to seeing you there. Now, economies around the world are bearing the brunt of COVID-19 restrictions, and governments have rallied to protect their markets. In April, Australia's unemployment rate grew a full percentage point to 6.2%. That's the country's largest ever monthly jump in unemployment. To ease the burden on the population and protect the economy, federal and state governments launched unprecedented stimulus packages. The federal government's job seeker payment forms a large part of this effort. More than 1.6 million people are currently receiving the unemployment benefit, which for a single person with no children sits at a little over $1,165 per fortnight. That's nearly double the rate before the COVID-19 crisis. But the $550 coronavirus supplement is due to expire in September, and many are asking what should happen next to the job seeker payment. And to discuss this question, we've invited Professor Peter Whiteford into our virtual podcast studio today. Peter is a professor at Crawford School, and he was previously the principal administrator in the Directorate of Employment, Labour and Social Affairs at the OECD in Paris. Hello, Peter. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
Thanks again for joining us on the podcast. It's great to have you back on. So, first of all, for the benefit of our listeners, can you briefly explain the difference between JobKeeper and JobSeeker?
Well, as you said, JobSeeker is a social security payment. So it's a payment made by Services Australia, what used to be called Centrelink. It's a payment of a bit over $1,100 a fortnight, as you said, which is about equivalent to 80% of the minimum wage. So it's a social security payment, and it's just temporarily been increased by what's called the coronavirus supplement. There have also been other significant changes made to the payment temporarily in order to make it easier for people to claim the payment. So the assets test that applied and the waiting periods that applied to the payment haven't been operating since the coronavirus supplement was introduced. JobKeeper is a different payment. It's made to employers in order to support people who might otherwise lose their jobs. So it's about $1,500 a fortnight. So it's actually roughly equivalent to a full-time minimum wage. It's paid in a more complicated way, basically because you need to have details of the employers in order to give the payment to the employers, who then have to pass it on to their workers. Now, it appears as if there's more than 6 million workers receiving this. You could sort of think of it as a wage subsidy. As I said, you have to stay attached to the employer, and the employer has to pass on the full $1,500 a fortnight to their workers, no matter what they had earned previously. So if they earned less than that, they might actually have a higher earnings. So to sum up, the aim of JobKeeper is to keep people attached to their employers. JobSeeker is a social security payment that's designed to support people at the moment when they become unemployed.
Now, I said in the intro that Australia had recently seen a very significant jump in its unemployment rate. I mean, do you have any sense of what the unemployment rate is going to look like over the next few months? How many more people are going to be needing to access JobSeeker into the future?
Well, the rise in the unemployment rate, which, as you said, is I think probably the fastest on record in a single month, is actually only a small part of the story. What's happened is there's been a significant withdrawal from the labour force. So people who had jobs have no longer have jobs, and they're not looking for work, which is what is the strict definition of unemployment. Now, that could be because they just don't think their job's around, or it also could be because they may have various forms of family responsibilities that they think they can't combine, looking after their families or children at the moment and also be looking for work. So I think there's an extra 600,000 or so who dropped out of the labour force at the same time. And then there's a lot of the people who are getting JobKeeper plus others who have had their hours of work reduced, or while still attached to their employer, are actually not actually putting in any hours of paid work because their employer is shut down. So lots of cafes, hotels, restaurants, and that sort of those sorts of people, as well as gyms, I assume, and a very wide range. So the labour market impact is already much, much bigger than is measured by the unemployment rate. And I think that if everybody had switched from their previous job into the unemployment rate, we'd be talking about an unemployment rate more like 13%, not 6%. There's a bit of controversy about how you measure it, but the effect on hours of work is much, much greater than the very large increase in unemployment.
Now, even before the coronavirus crisis hit, there were plenty of people calling for a significant increase of New Start of unemployment benefits. Do you believe that keeping the job seeker payment at its current rate is sustainable?
Well, I think that there's both a yes and a no answer to that. The no answer is that the coronavirus supplement is only designed to be temporary, and there are features of it which are not very sensible. In particular, you get the full supplement, which is about $275 a week, $550 a fortnight, only so long as you're getting some of the basic job seeker payment. Now, what that means, for example, is if somebody was working about 27 hours a week at the minimum wage, they would still be getting a few dollars worth of job seeker, and they would get the whole $550 worth of the supplement. However, if they were working 28 hours a week, they would completely lose the supplement. So what that means is, at that point, the take-home income of a single person would drop from about $720 a week to $508 a week. For an extra hour of work. So that's not very sensible. But the reason for it is that it's a temporary payment that's designed to fit the current crisis. That design is also probably not particularly problematic at the moment because, as I said, what's happened is that people's hours of work have dropped very substantially. So it's not as if they're having to choose between 27 and 28 hours a week or their employer is sort of asking them to work an extra hour. That's not the situation we're in at the moment. But as we start to recover and as work jobs open up and people go back to work, that will become more of an issue. So that it's also creates anomalies. So somebody working 3 hours a week and getting most of the payment at the moment would have a higher income than somebody working 30 hours a week. So that sort of anomaly is not particularly desirable in equity terms. So I think the supplement needs to be redesigned. So when it's due to end in September, I think it should be ended, but I think that we need to work out ways of keeping the payment at an adequate level. Before the supplement was added, Australia, the unemployment benefit for a single person in Australia was the lowest replacement rate in the OECD. So if you lost your job, you lost more of your income in Australia than in any other high income country. So the previous level of New Start, which became job seeker payment, I think is unsustainably low.
Now, you said there that job seeker was obviously a policy that was designed and rolled out in a hurry to meet a crisis situation, and it's clearly got some challenges in terms of its design. But what are some of those flaws of the policy that will need to be addressed going forward?
What we need to do is have something which maintains an adequate level of income for people after September, but doesn't have this sort of sudden death loss of most of the benefit when you reach a certain income level. So what you have to do is build an increase into the base rates of payment. Now, the government doesn't seem to like that because that then becomes a sort of permanent increase as opposed to the supplement is temporary, so it'll go away in September. The other issue, which I think is really important, and the Grattan Institute has pointed this out, Deloitte Access Economics, and also Mike Keating, who was a former Secretary of the Department of Finance and head of the Prime Minister's Department in the 1990s, has also pointed out that if we just allow the job seeker payment and the job keeper payments to expire, the incomes of millions of people will drop enormously late in September. So we would expect to have a double dip recession. So I don't think the government can actually allow the payments to completely expire. So they have to work out how to phase it out, and they have to work out how to structure the system going forward that provides adequate support.
Now, the government has been pretty reticent in the past to consider raising the rate of the New Start payments. So do you think there is any hope that they might look to that September day and go forward with the sort of staged sort of process that you're talking about there? Or will it be sort of falling off the cliff for those people on those benefits?
Yeah, my understanding is that if you just have that sort of cliff where both the job keeper and the job seeker payment just ends, you'll have a massive loss of income amongst the poorest members of the community. Now, if you take the job keeper payment, as I said, apparently there's a bit over 6 million jobs being supported by that. There's an estimate that if it wasn't for JobKeeper, about a million of those would have joined the unemployment queue. And it's also unclear what's going to happen to the other jobs, whether the sort of hibernation theory that we've supposedly been having, that the worker and their employer sort of goes into deep freeze for a few months and then comes out of it. If that doesn't work, we're going to have much, much higher unemployment than we've had at any time since the Great Depression. Now, one of the lessons of the Great Depression, as I understand it, was that you don't keep cutting people's incomes in a depression. You have to support them. And I think it's my reading of the sort of a lot of the economists in Australia and also internationally is that we have to keep up support for both the unemployed and for jobs. Now, the precise way you do that is, there are probably quite a lot of ways of doing it, but I think that cliff where the payments, one payment disappears and the other one halves, would be a pretty much an economic disaster, really.
Okay, well, let's take a quick break there, but when we come back, we'll continue discussing this topic.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi, I'm Mark Kenny. Each week on the Democracy Sausage Pod, we serve up fresh, meaty analysis of Australia's politics and policy and chew the fat with some of the country's leading experts. It's the podcast for those who like sizzling scrutiny with just a touch of sauce. You can find Democracy Sausage on iTunes, Spotify, or at policyforum.net/podcasts.
Welcome back. Peter Wyford is still here with me, and I want to turn to the recent Senate inquiry report into the adequacy of Newstart / JobSeeker that was released last month. And one of the recommendations in that was that once the coronavirus supplement is phased out, the Australian government increase the JobSeeker payment, youth allowance and parenting payment rates to ensure that all eligible recipients do not live in poverty. Peter, what do we mean by poverty in this context?
Well, that's not quite the $64,000 question, but getting on towards it. I mean, poverty is often a contested concept. The most common way that's used in European countries and is also used in research in Australia is to say someone's poor when their disposable income is less than half the median income for the entire population. So the median, people know, is the midpoint. So exactly half the population are below it and half are above it. And if you take half the median, what you're saying is you're some distance away from what's the normal living standards in your society. So it's a measure of relative poverty. So the 50% of median income is, as I said, used in most Australian research and is also used in a lot of European policies, although in Europe they actually define people as being at risk of poverty if their income is less than 60% of the median. So it's a higher standard in many countries. The other sort of approach, which in many respects corresponds to people's sort of intuitive understanding of poverty, is you can use things called budget standards. These have been developed overseas, and basically what researchers do is they try to specify literally everything that people in defined circumstances need to have an adequate standard of living. So they work out what's a nutritious diet, they work out how often you need to replace your clothing and your shoes, they work out how much you need to pay in rent, what your electricity bills would be depending on the number of people in the household, and so on. And they build up from these budget standards to an overall living standard. Now, when the Social Policy Research Centre at the University of New South Wales has been doing this for some time. Now, when they have done this most recently, they actually come up with a dollar figure that is sort of only a few dollars a week, less than the 50% of median income poverty line. So that seems to be, these two different methods, which are the sort of main alternatives, come up with a number in Australia that's broadly similar. Having said that, there's a lot of technicalities in measuring poverty. And say, for example, it depends on how you adjust for the number of people living in households. How much economies of scale do you think there are, you know, when there are two people living together compared to one person living by themselves, and how much economies of scale there are for people with children. So, yeah, do the number of bedrooms need to increase according to the number of people? The heating doesn't increase according to the number of people. Probably the food does, and things like this. So there's a degree of complexity in that. And the Senate inquiry, while its final recommendation, the majority of the Senate inquiry, which is non-government members, recommended that when the coronavirus supplement is phased out, that payments be raised to keep people out of poverty. But their very first recommendation was that we need an inquiry into how much the poverty line should be. So that sort of says we need to raise it to something, but they're not quite sure how much that is. So what I think is a basis in the short run is to raise the working age payments to the level of the pension. There's quite a wide gap between pension and benefit rates. The pension rates were pretty comprehensively reviewed in 2008 by the Harmer Review, which ended in recommending a very large increase in pensions at the time. And while there are situations in which people on pensions also don't have adequate incomes, it's a much more adequate level of income than the old New Start is. So my suggestion is that we should, in the first instance, raise working age payments to the pension rates, and then when we've got the time to have a look at the poverty research and how you define the poverty line and reach consensus about what that means, that you do that research after September, not it can't be finished before September.
So what is that rate for the pensions, and why that figure in particular?
What it would do is it would mean that you would have a uniform level of payment for all low-income people in Australia. So whether you're unemployed, whether you have a disability, whether you're caring for somebody with disability, whether you're a lone parent, whether you're aged over, it's about 65 and a half now to get the age pension. So it gives a common floor. It treats people equally. It follows a recommendation quite a long time ago now of the Henderson Inquiry into Poverty back in the 1970s, where Professor Ronald Henderson from the University of Melbourne was commissioned first by a coalition government before the 1972 election, and was continued by the Labor government after that, to have what was probably Australia's most comprehensive inquiry into poverty. And one of the very strong principles that the Henderson Inquiry put up was that payments should be based on people's needs, not on sort of arbitrary categories of either whether they're deserving or undeserving, or what particular age they are as well.
So how much would the change that you are suggesting cost the government? And can the government afford it? I mean, we've just come off the back of a period where the government has pumped, hundreds of billions of dollars into propping up the economy. And coming out the other side of this crisis, you'd imagine they're going to have to try and work out how they pay that money back. Can the government afford what it is that you're proposing, and how much will it actually cost them to do that?
Just in terms of the costings, it primarily depends on how many people are receiving payments in September and going forward from that. So obviously, the more people who are unemployed, the more people who are out of jobs, the more costly it's going to be. There was an estimate that ACOS, the Council for Social Services, has for many years been recommending an increase in New Start. Their most recent budget submission was recommending a $95 a week increase in New Start. If we raised job seeker to the age pension level, it would be about $185 a week, so twice what ACOS has recommended in the past. The what would happen is that in the short run, as I said, if we use the same number of people as were on payments when ACOS made their estimate, which was about 850,000, that would be double the cost. But then there's also the cost of helping people on parenting payment and a range of other youth payments, so that would go up. So I think we'd be talking about $9 billion a year, the full year cost, based on 850,000, based on about a million people receiving it. Now, as you mentioned earlier, there's currently about 1.6 million people receiving JobSeeker, and unfortunately, it could be 2 million or more in September. It's very hard to tell. So if it was 2 million, we'd be talking about $18 billion, right? Or between $18 and $20 billion. So it's a very high cost from some perspectives. Now, having said that, as you mentioned, the while governments like to argue that there's no magic money tree, which is an expression that both the government here and the government in the United Kingdom have used in recent years. When they needed to, they came up with $130 billion for the JobKeepers payment. Now, there's in thinking about the sort of $20 billion in a full year, the other thing to remember is that in September, the government, if it doesn't do this, is going to be taking a lot of money out of the economy. They're going to be dramatically reducing the amount of support they provide. So the $20 billion, while it sounds an awful lot of money, is actually a lot less than the money that's going to be coming out of the economy. And if they felt they just had to continue the current arrangements, that would be much more expensive than this increase in the base rates of working age payments. So the cost, you have to compare the cost of doing this with the cost of what we're doing at the moment, and also the cost, the economic cost, if we don't do this. Now, I'm not a macroeconomist. There are some very good ones in the Crawford School you could talk to about this. My reading of what people are saying is, though, that in the short run, it would be a serious mistake, economic mistake, to try and dramatically reduce the budget deficit in a few years. That it would, it would be contractionary. So you'd be trying to come out of the biggest economic contraction, in Australian history, and then try to contract some more. So I personally, as I said, it's my reading of other economists, is that that in the short run we don't need to worry about the debt. Governments and people often think of the analogy of the household, and they say, you can't live beyond your means. Well, most households in Australia and many in other countries aim to have mortgages, and you have a mortgage, which is a debt that you have, which is many times your annual income, and you pay it off over 35 or 40 years. And I think that's what we need to think about in Australia. We need to think that, yes, we're going to have a much larger debt, but if we try to pay it off too quickly, we're actually going to make the problem worse, not better, and that we need to think about it will take decades to pay back this debt. But that's, what happened with the Second World War, right? It took us decades to grow out of that debt, and the economic impact of this is so big that I think we need to think in terms of decades, not, the next two or three years.
Finally, many would argue that the government's resistance to previously increasing the rate of Newstar wasn't purely on economic terms. There was also some ideology that underpins this. So do you think that the sort of economic pragmatist arguments that you set out there in terms of trying to avoid that double dip recession at the end of the day will prove more powerful to the government than their own feelings and stance towards the rate of Newstar stroke job seeker?
Well, as you said, it sort of appears to be the case that government attitudes towards the unemployed have been very much in the last, for quite a long period of time, have been very much the idea of them and us, you know, that there's these people who are, you know, this is not very pleasant Australian term, dull bludgers, you know, that they're not making a productive contribution to the economy, and whereas there's the rest of us who are sort of fine, upstanding taxpayers. So there's been very much that that sort of dichotomy between them and us, and it's been expressed not only in not raising Newstart, but through a whole range of other initiatives. So, you know, sort of the government's proposed drug testing people applying for social security benefits. There's the cashless welfare card that they have introduced in various locations. We have really significantly higher levels of requirements for people to actively look for work in Australia than in many other countries. So there's a lot of stigmatisation and sort of administrative burden that's been placed that has been placed on social security recipients. So it's a pretty strong theme in Australian policy. I mean, it also applies in other countries as well, but maybe a bit more so here. But I think hopefully the pragmatic arguments. I mean, we need to think of the social security system as part of our essential economic infrastructure. When you look back at the first stimulus packages, not all that many weeks ago, the way the government delivered it was, the $750 payment to households was through the social security system. The social security system is, you know, one of the few administrative mechanisms governments have for getting money directly to households. And the expansion of JobSeeker was also the same. It's, you know, that we have it's got problems, but we have a pretty relatively efficient social security system that's able to get money out to people and is, you know, at times like this, is an essential tool of economic management. So I think that we need to think about the efficiency arguments. I think the fact that the government, I presume under the advice from Treasury, so quickly completely reversed some of the things it's done in the past is a sign that, they're pragmatic. And so I have hope that they will pragmatically try to deal with the very substantial economic problems that seem to face us in the next years or more.
Well, this has been a fascinating discussion. So thanks so much, Peter, for sharing your insights with us today.
My pleasure.
Listeners, we really hope you enjoyed today's episode. If so, you might want to leave us a quick review on Apple Podcasts. You can also find us on Acast and Spotify or wherever you get your favourite podcasts from. And don't forget to hit that subscribe button. If you want to get in touch with us, send us your feedback, questions, thoughts or suggestions. They're always welcome. You can find us on Twitter as APPS Policy Forum, that's Apps Policy Forum, or send us a good old-fashioned email, podcast@policyforum.net. And a quick reminder that the best way to connect with us is through our Facebook group, Policy Forum Pod. Don't forget to join us there. We'll be back soon with another episode of Policy Forum Pod. But until then, stay safe, keep your distance, look after one another, and cheerio for now.
Up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.